Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, September 18th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 348 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We're happy to be out of YouTube jail, and we're now streaming on Rumble as well as Twitter/X. Facebook and Instagram. So wherever you're watching us from, thanks for joining us. And Ali, do you want to say a few words about our ongoing brush with censorship?
Yeah, we didn't know until a couple of hours ago whether we'd be able to be live on YouTube. They were very vague about when our punitive suspension would end. But as people can see, what we've done is to expand the number of platforms we're available on. So people are watching right now on YouTube, but they're also watching live on Twitter, on Facebook, on Twitch, on Rumble, on Instagram. And we are committed to support all those platforms so that if any of them decides to censor us, we will still be available. We're still trying to address this issue with YouTube because we're not out of the woods. They can censor us again. They can, suspend us again. The next time they decide to do it, it will be for 2 weeks. And after that, who knows what they might do. And over the last week, we have thought very carefully about the videos that they have decided to censor. And we can only conclude that this is purely arbitrary and purely political. We've been very careful about abiding by their guidelines. So other alternative media face the same type of censorship on various platforms. It's the world we live in. And sadly, there's more and more calls for this kind of censorship, but we're going to continue to do all we can to be heard and to continue to reach people. And I'll just take this opportunity to say hello to all those who are watching on all the additional platforms, including Rumble and Twitch, which are relatively new for us, as well as Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, which we've been on for much longer.
Thanks so much for that, Ali. All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk to members of Palestine Action in the UK about their ongoing campaign to destroy property at arms factories and how they've become a major target of British state repression. Later on in the program, John will take us through the resistance news from Gaza and Yemen and focus in on the latest from Lebanon. And we'll have a discussion about the Israeli terrorist attacks in Lebanon yesterday and again today using booby-trapped personal communications devices. So please stay tuned for that. But first, here's a summary of some of the latest developments in Gaza and the West Bank. And we'll also share some reportage highlights from the Electronic Intifada's contributors there. Israel attacked Gaza City in the north and Burej refugee camp in the central area on Tuesday. As people rushed their loved ones who were killed and injured in the Burej bombing to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported that medical supplies are lacking, bandages and pain medications are unavailable, and the hospital, quote, has turned into a stage for funerals. The attacks on Burej followed an attack on the nearby Nuseirat refugee camp on Monday, where at least 10 Palestinians were killed. At least 25 others were killed around Gaza on Monday, including in Gaza City, Beit Lahia, Khan Yunus, and Rafah. Journalists reported that the Israeli military has been attacking and demolishing homes in Nuseirat in order to widen the area around the Netzarim corridor where the army is stationed and has bisected the Gaza Strip. Earlier in the week, Israel attacked homes and residential buildings in Khan Yunus, Rafah, Gaza City, and Jabalia refugee camp, where Israeli forces bombed a kindergarten that was being used as a shelter for forcibly displaced families. The attack killed at least 10 and injured dozens more as they slept. Here's Al Jazeera's Anas Al-Sharif reporting over the weekend.
I'm here in Jabalia refugee camp near the Yemeni hospital, where Israeli warplanes have fired a missile, directly and without warning, at the Al-Suwaidan family home. Medical teams and civil defense units are recovering the dead and injured. They're also searching the rubble for a number of missing people.
Israeli warplanes targeted the house, completely destroying it and killing several people. Others are missing. Our teams are trying to find them and recover the bodies of the dead. The problem is that we cannot reach all of the victims. It's difficult to work in this area, which is completely destroyed.
This man was just rescued from under the rubble. He is one of the survivors of the Israeli attack on this house, which was full of people. Scenes like this are repeated every night as the genocide and war against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip continues. Every Israeli strike kills people, wounds people, and leaves others missing.
Anas al-Sharif, Al Jazeera.
That was Al Jazeera's Anas al-Sharif reporting from Jabalia. On Saturday, Israel bombed a fuel refinery in northern Gaza used to transform plastic into gasoline that is required to operate civil defense vehicles and electricity generators for hospitals. Homes were destroyed and workers were killed in the attack, according to reporter Abdelkader Sabah. The Gaza government media office stated on Sunday that a journalist was killed. Abdullah Shakshak, who worked for several local and regional Arabic language media outlets, was targeted by an Israeli quadcopter drone in Rafah on Saturday. More than 170 journalists have been killed by Israel since the genocide began in October 2023. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza has released a 649-page document listing the names, ages, genders, and ID numbers of every Palestinian recorded killed in Israeli attacks in the last 11 and a half months of this genocide. The number of Palestinians killed is estimated to be much higher than the recorded death count of 40,000, since thousands more are missing or buried under the rubble. The first 226 pages list the names of children 18 years old and younger, including 14 pages of newborns and babies under a year old. And the last 11 pages list the names of Palestinian elders from the ages of 77 to 101 years old, all older than the state of Israel itself. A coalition of 15 international aid organizations have announced that as a consequence of Israel's ongoing obstruction of aid, 83% of required food does not make it past the crossing points at the Gaza-Israel boundaries, accelerating the humanitarian and health disaster for the entire population of Gaza and placing almost 500,000 people at risk of starvation. The aid groups add that a record low average of 69 aid trucks per day entered Gaza in August, compared to 500 per working day last year, which was already not enough to meet people's needs. In August, more than 1 million people did not receive any food rations in southern and central Gaza. The United Nations Health Cluster reported this week that this denial of aid into Gaza is also expanding the hygiene and health safety crisis, with Israel denying soap, shampoo, and detergents into Gaza. The cluster says that, quote, community kitchens and healthcare facilities lack the minimum cleaning materials, worsening the unsanitary conditions in shelters and clinics. The UN also warned that the upcoming rainy season will exacerbate the already fragile shelter conditions. Quote, with the magnitude of destruction to urban areas, roads, and critical infrastructure this year, flooding patterns can be expected to be unpredictable and disastrous for those seeking shelter. Most displaced people are sheltering in small, overcrowded makeshift shelters on self-settled sites, typically having deteriorated plastic sheeting for roofing, while the remaining live in tents, many of which are overcrowded. Others are sheltering in damaged or unfinished buildings, which are unsafe. With an average of only 2 truckloads of shelter-related items per week entering South Gaza in August, the UN's shelter cluster estimates that partners would need 2 years to deliver the equivalent of the most basic winterization support needed now. At least 25,000 sealing-off kits, or 25 truckloads, need to be delivered per week to South Gaza for people to be supported before more significant rainfall and lower temperatures arrive in November. This week, we're highlighting a feature by our contributor Fida Al-Kedra in Gaza about a 10-year-old girl who was killed earlier this month while she was playing in the street wearing her pink roller skates. She writes, "I reached Hussam Abu Ajwa on his phone. What do you ask a man who has lost a child? What does a bereaved father say? Abu Ajwa, whose daughter Tala, 10, was killed on September 5th, reached for the words of Mahmoud Darwish, a reply the late poet, while ailing and waiting to die, gave to a reporter's question about how he felt. Bruised feelings and broken thoughts and some scratched up memories. The doctor says nothing is fatal, just a little loss to the soul. Tala had been playing with her friends when a bomb struck a downstairs apartment in Gaza City, killing her on the spot and adding her name to the list of the nearly 17,000 children Israel has killed in Gaza since October last year. A photograph of Tala under a white shroud wearing her pink roller skates subsequently went viral on social media. Not more than 5 minutes had gone by after Tala left with her pink skates when Abu Ajwa said he heard a loud explosion. I ran quickly from the third floor to the street, he said. Abu Ajwa found Tala's body face down, covered in rubble and dust, only her roller skates visible. He picked up her battered body and rushed to a hospital. It was too late. The medical staff could not save Tala's life. Tala aspired to be a dentist, her father said. The day before she was killed, Abu Ajwa said, a bomb struck near their building and sent Tala running to the safety of his arms. I am sad because over the last year, my daughter had to experience so much fear and so many things children shouldn't know, like starvation and displacement, Abu Ajwa said. And then she was killed while skating, trying to make herself happy. For more, read Fida Al-Kedra's feature, Pink Skates and Deadly Bombs, on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers attacked children and teachers at an elementary school northwest of Jericho on Monday. The Palestinian news agency Wafa said that armed Israelis stormed the Arab Al-Kabne school and assaulted students and teachers. The United Nations Education Cluster added that the settlers were armed with clubs and tied up the school's principal. Footage from the attack shows a group of male settlers marching into the school, and one can hear the screams of children and the teachers during the attack. The school employs 30 teachers who serve around 100 students, the UN said. When Israeli forces arrived, it was reported that they arrested the school principal. The Israeli police also confiscated the school's digital video recorder, which the police claimed was in order to review the incident. Video footage shows the identities of most of the assailants. One student told the Reuters news agency that, quote, we were studying as usual in class. Then they started saying that settlers attacked the school. I was able to gather my siblings so that nothing happens to them. I was able to gather them in a classroom, and the settlers started banging on the glass, trying to open it against our will. On Tuesday, Israeli settlers attacked the village of Hirbet al-Farisiya in the northern Jordan Valley. Wafa said that at least four settlers tried to steal livestock from one Palestinian resident of the village, quote, but he bravely confronted them and prevented them from doing so. And finally, we wanted to bring you some images and videos from journalists and others in Gaza that highlight the resilience, joy, and determination of the Palestinian people. Palestinian teacher Isra Abu Mustafa created a classroom in a tent on the ruins of her destroyed house at the beginning of what would usually be the new school year. Journalist Hassan Isle filmed this video of the young students eager to learn.
Marhaba li zaruna, marhaba li zaruna.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you for that news roundup. As usual, it's been a tough week and hard to keep up with everything. So that roundup really, really helps.
Thanks. Yeah.
And, you know, and we're trying to keep up with the news as it's happening right now. So just a headline that just came up now. Lebanon has raised the death toll from today's attack to 9, with over 300 injured. And that's on top of the thousands injured and 12 killed yesterday. So we don't know what may happen the next hour, let alone tomorrow.
After John's report, we'll be discussing what we know and what we don't yet, try to analyze as best we can how this is going to go for the people of the region. So stay tuned for that. Ali, why don't you introduce our first guest?
Yes, and just a reminder, you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream, and I'm Ali Abunima with my colleague Nora Barrows-Friedman. And today we'll be talking to returning guests Huda Amori and Max Geller from the Direct Action Group Palestine Action. They are continuing their campaigns against Elbit Systems, the largest private Israeli arms manufacturer, which has factories and facilities across the UK, actually in many countries, but we'll be talking about the UK, including sites that design and are involved in manufacturing deadly drones that are being used in the genocide in Gaza right now, like Elbit's Hermes 450 drone. As well as murdering Palestinians on October 7th, these drones, it should be noted, have even been used to bomb many Israelis who were captured by Palestinian fighters. And that's an important detail often forgotten amid all the false claims about Palestinian atrocities that day. Now, there's been a long and storied history in the UK of nonviolent resistance to the arms trade. But Palestine Action has really been the first group to campaign against a company like Elbit in a sustained campaign of direct action over many years. And it's been able to do so because of growing support it's received, including from local communities, which often had no idea of the presence of, say, an Israeli drones part factory in their neighborhood. It's also significant that on several occasions, British juries have refused to convict Palestine Action members for damaging property, and they've accepted the arguments that such actions are legally justifiable because they aim to prevent far greater harm in the form of Israel's war crimes and genocide. Palestine Action has seen significant victories, and last time Huda was on the live stream, which was in March, she told us that Palestine Action had managed to shut down two Elbit facilities in the UK, its factory in Oldham and its headquarters in London. And they also pressured four other companies which were providing services to Elbit to withdraw those services. So it's no doubt due to their persistence and effectiveness that Palestine Action is a primary target of the British government's growing repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And right now, several of their activists are currently being held as political prisoners in British jails, including co-founder Richard Barnard, who is facing so-called terrorism charges. And many other activists have had their homes ransacked by police. So let's go to Huda and Max and welcome them back to the program.
Hi, Huda and Max. So good to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to try and do this. We're going to hope that the sound is okay. If not, we're gonna do our best to adapt. But let's get right into it, Huda. We'll talk more about the repression that you're facing. But first, update us on how the campaign is going. What are the significant developments or victories you've seen since you last spoke to us in March?
Yes, so last time we shut down two Elbit facilities in this country. And recently we permanently closed down another one of Elbit weapons factories in Staffordshire. It was a factory that produced parts for Israeli tanks. And after sustained direct action against the site, the profits had reduced by 75% because of their increased security costs. And eventually they had to sell the site to a new company who have distanced themselves from doing anything to do with the military or anything to do with Israel and Elbit. And now the factory is making parts for public transport. So quite a transformation from making parts for Israeli tanks to parts for public transport. We've also had other companies since cut ties with Elbit Systems and major divestments from places like Scotiabank, who have more than halved their investment in Elbit Systems, who are the largest foreign shareholder in the company. So we continue to see huge victories, but also every single action we have is a victory against Elbit Systems. Every time we manage to shut them down, break into their facility, or expose vulnerabilities, and we're able to stop them being able to manufacture these weapons, which they market as battle-tested on the Palestinian people. And the actions have not stopped. If anything, they have intensified.
Can you give us an update on Richard Barnard's hearing that Ali mentioned happened earlier today? Tell us what he's facing and what happened at the hearing.
Yes, yeah, so just to clarify, Richard isn't in prison. He's released on bail. And today he had his first hearing for new charges. These are three different charges for two speeches that he made in October last year. One count of Section 12, 1A under the Terrorism Act, which is inviting support for a prescribed organization, Hamas, and two counts for encouraging criminal damage, as they say, against Israeli weapons factories under Section 44 of the Serious Crime Act. What's interesting about this is that the Section 44 offences, we were both charged with that and we went to trial at the end of last year, and they said because we encourage direct action against Elbit Systems that we should go to trial on those charges. We defeated those charges. We were unanimously acquitted by a jury, and now they are retrialing him on exactly the same charge for calling for direct action once again. So it's very vindictive. But this time they're adding the terrorism element in a bid to really try and persecute Richard, but by doing so to send a message to the movement, to try and intimidate us into stopping our movement, which is not going to work. But he has now been referred to the Old Bailey, the Central Criminal Court in London. And so he'll have another hearing on October 4th.
And Huda, just I do apologize about that error, and I'm glad to hear that Richard is not in jail. And just to clarify, are there members of the group who are currently in detention?
Yes, so we currently have 16 political prisoners right now, 10 of whom were detained under the Terrorism Act. They were actually held in military confinement for a week, interrogated repeatedly, not given adequate amounts of food before they were charged with non-terror offences and remanded to prison. So remand means being held in prison before trial. That happened after six of them had broken into Elbit's new research facility in Filton, Bristol. And this facility was obviously very precious to Elbit, but £5 million building it, and activists had managed to break inside despite it's supposed to be supposedly being highly secured. And when they were inside the facility, they destroyed, this is on video, Israeli quadcopter drones, the same model of drones we're seeing used in Gaza, the same model of drones that we've seen mimic the sounds of women and children crying so they lure Palestinians and kill them. Those were inside that site, and they managed to destroy them. And in a bid to punish them and deter them, they held them under the Terrorism Act, abusing counterterrorism powers. We have another one, Francesca, who published a letter on Electronic Intifada. He's being held as well in Wakefield, who took action against Barclays and also against an American weapons factory. And we also have five who've been sentenced in Scotland for taking action against a weapons factory in Glasgow.
That is, of course, people putting themselves at a great personal risk to do this work. Max, we've just heard from Huda that she and Richard were acquitted by a jury on very serious charges. Of course, that doesn't mean that the British state is going to give up. And just a couple of days ago, Palestine Action announced that another jury, refused to convict four actionists who cost Teledyne's weapons factory over £500,000 in damages. That's probably, I think, around $750,000, by disrupting the production of Israeli missile parts. And this acquittal came even though the judge had sharply restricted the defenses that the accused individuals were allowed to make, and yet the jury still refused to convict them. But I understand they are going to be retried because it was a hung jury. The question I want to ask you, Max, to comment on that, why you think juries are doing this, and talk about, you know, you've been an activist in the Palestine Solidarity Movement for many years in both the US and now the UK. Why did you choose Palestine Action and to get involved in this kind of work when you moved to the UK, knowing the kind of risks that are involved? And what's the significance of how quickly it appears to have won victories that have eluded other kinds of movements who've been working for an arms embargo or an end to the arms trade for years?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the news that you're referring to, at the Teledyne action that the British state failed to convict on, this is an excellent news story. This is really a beautiful story that we can all celebrate together. They had these four activists, you know, the government felt like they had them dead to rights. There was no defenses available to them. The destruction of this weapons factory was on video. And yet, during a genocide, a British jury of these four actionist peers refused to convict them. And I think this is the silent majority speaking here. After a full year of ineffective marching, marches that don't yield the results that we've all been, you know, desperate for, it's nice to see true democracy in action. Even though the British state won't listen to its people, the judge had no choice but to listen to this jury and set those four actionists free. It's also, I think, indicative of why you see the state coming up with these new types of charges for Palestine actionists. If juries will not convict, they have to come up with a way of detaining indefinitely without charge. And the Terrorism Act provides that. It is one of the most draconian and fascist legal apparatuses available to the state. These victories that Huda is discussing are coming, you know, in spite of an extremely repressive new British government. The speech Richard Barnard gave was back in October when there was a different administration in power. That administration, a Tory administration, a conservative government, refused to charge Richard. And this liberal new government had no problem using the Terrorism Act to try and shut down Palestine action. It just goes to show, I think, how effective we are, because if we weren't effective, they wouldn't be trying to throw terrorism charges at us. It's in the same way that I don't think YouTube would be censoring your live stream if it weren't such an important platform. I think all of these things are extremely related, and it feels extremely empowering to be part of an organization that has that is willing to put to do what's necessary during a genocide to stop it. I mean, the 16 people who are in jail are truly some of the most noble, beautiful souls I've ever met, and I know a bunch of them. You know, like it's a I've never had this experience, you know, in my years of activism where so many of my friends are in jail right now. It's part of the reality that we're all living in. And these people are just like me. They're just like, you know, they're from similar backgrounds and they're like determined to stop this genocide with their own hands. And I can just say that, like, at these trials, the response from the public is really wonderful and scary to the British authorities, because at today's hearing, there was over 100 people outside. And I get, you know, I'm one of the people who's on the support, the prisoner support teams, and we're getting letters from inspired people all around the world. All around the world, people are paying attention to how the British government are treating our brave actionists. And they're saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. This isn't consistent with what's going on. There's something really the matter here. And I think it's clarifying for people.
And Max, what are you calling on people to do in support of these political prisoners? What are the kinds of things people watching today can do to support them?
It's a great question. As of right now, we have two of our actionists who are being held in violation of their rights without phone and without communication from the outside world. Every single one of their letters has been censored and withheld from them so far. And we're talking about dozens a day. They're all across the UK. People are sending in postcards to these actionists. And I think they're up on the screen now. And the prison warden has refused to deliver their mail. So we
and
have
their names there. Just sorry, just on the screen, William Plasto and Ian Saunders, for those who are listening to the broadcast and not seeing it. Sorry, Max.
No, not at all. And so we have started a letter writing campaign to the warden demanding that she give William and Ian their mail as consistent with British law. They've also been denied phone calls for no reason. It's just another way of punishing Palestinian activists for the crime of being in solidarity and against the British state.
Well, in the past few months, we've seen, of course, a huge uptick in global campaigns of repression by Western states, primarily targeting the Palestine Solidarity Movement. We talked on the stream a couple weeks ago about activist and social media user Sarah Wilkinson and how her home was raided by UK, quote, anti-terror police. Ali has been banned by Germany in an attempt to stop him from speaking about the genocide. What do you think accounts for this upsurge in repression right now? As you know, as you mentioned, I mean, the public, you know, has overwhelmingly been in support of Palestine actionists. and yet, you know, Keir Starmer's government is trying to just throw the entire book at them. A question for you both, but let's start with Max.
The victories that we're getting are not victories that have been normally associated with the solidarity movement. Victories, and it's not just here in the UK, people who use direct action tactics against Israeli targets win. We had an amazing victory of an Israeli weapons facility in Cambridge, Massachusetts, being forced to shutter its doors 2 weeks ago. This followed a sustained direct action campaign. This type of repeated action and showing up over and over and over again is, has always been a blueprint for victory. And these types of victories, which go again, you know, which fly in the face of U.S. imperialism, are really scary to the U.S. state and its clients.
Yeah. Huda, what are your thoughts on that?
I think Elba's days are numbered in this country, and they know that. When you can't secure your facilities, when people continue to occupy, break in, and destroy your weaponry, there's only so much you can take. We've seen them, they've been forced to sell and shut down several factories already. And I think they are on the edge of leaving this country for good. And I think the state is responding to try and protect them. And when you've already imprisoned people, and that hasn't worked, when you take people to court and remove their right to lawful defenses to argue that their crimes are lawfully, to uphold international law, to prevent the greater crime, and that doesn't work to stop people, then terrorism really is the end of the road in terms of tactics that the state can try and use to try and deter people from taking this type of action. So I think actually they've just shown that we are closer than ever before to victory, to getting rid of Elbit systems in this country, and they're desperate to stop us. We know that Elbit have complained about the detrimental impacts we are having to their business, and they're showing that through these prosecutions. And I forgot to mention before, but today at Richard's meeting, it was confirmed that Labour's Attorney General was the one, as Max said, it's Labour's government who authorised these charges. We haven't seen people be detained under the Terrorism Act until Labour came into power. And we haven't seen these kind of charges be brought against people until Labour's Attorney General consented to Richard being charged under the Terrorism Act. So this government is desperate to protect Elbit systems. But at this point, we're at a unique time in history where they are going to do everything to try and stop us. They will put more people in prison. But when you continue at this point, when you continue to grow, which we are as a movement, that's when Elbit realized that they have to leave this country. Nothing is going to stop us.
Yeah. Huda, you, before you co-founded Palestine Action, you were a campaigns officer at the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which is a well-known organization in the UK. It organizes large marches. You worked on different kinds of campaigning methods, such as lobbying politicians and institutions. And of course, those are things that people still do and that are in themselves valuable. But what lessons have you learned after being involved in a variety of tactics over the years? And can you talk about where you see different tactics fitting into this movement at this time?
Yeah, so my experience at PSC really was a major part of my campaigning life that spurred me on to taking direct action and to starting Palestine Action with other like-minded people. And I think you get to a point when you realize you're trying the same tactics over and over again. And despite the limitations of what you're doing, you're told to just keep doing the same thing over and over again. And there's a lot of respectability politics to play as well when it comes to these politicians. And you know, you're banging yourself against a brick wall constantly and not getting results, or not getting results that match the severity of what Israel is doing to the Palestinian people. And I think it was really those limitations that are set by these kind of bigger organizations that led me to take direct action against Israel weapons trade, because I was just sick and tired of, you know, I'd done lots of research against institutions, their investments in these companies, pointing out the hypocrisy against their own ethical investment policies, lobbying politicians, armed embargo campaign to stop arming Israel. And you're constantly getting the same feedback, the same lack of interest, or deliberate lack of interest, because there was a heavy Israel lobby at play, and told to do the same thing. And I just believe that when we have Israeli weapons factories operating in our doorstep, and rather than beg someone to stop killing our brothers and sisters in Palestine, I could just go up there, like many people have done in Palestine Action, and just go shut them down ourselves. And we have done that. And to be honest, it's the most, it's strange to say, but it's liberating. And it's very empowering when you let go of those constraints. You know, we're often told, just ask nicely, you know, be respectable to the politicians, and maybe they'll try and stop killing our brothers and sisters in Palestine. That has not worked. And actually, when you realize that you have power in yourself to go climb on a ladder or break into a factory, and you can literally destroy the site and stop them from operating, then that's what we need to go ahead and do. And so I think direct action is, there is a place for everything in this movement, but direct action plays a significant part, and the whole movement needs to be supportive of each other. And that includes, you know, when we're facing repression, like we're facing in Palestine Action, what the state tries to do is isolate parts of the movement from other parts. They're trying to say, look, you know, we're using counterterrorism powers against people. They're testing the waters to see how the wider movement reacts, and stand in solidarity with one another, and don't allow them to isolate certain parts of our movement. That's when the state fails. And that's when they back down as well, because they realize the amount of support that we have for each other within this movement. And there needs to be a lot more of that from the bigger organizations towards groups like Palestine Action, especially at this point in time.
I can just reflect listening to you, Huda. I remember the aftermath of 9/11. I don't like to think about 9/11 very much, but after the September 11, 2001 attacks, there was a great deal of repression in the United States, and the Bush administration went particularly after Palestinian Americans who had absolutely nothing to do with the September 11th attacks. But there was a wave of prosecutions, the Holy Land Five, there were other cases. Who are still in prison for decades for raising money for charities that were also funded by the United States government in Palestine. And there was the case of Samuel Arian and the repression his family went through. There was the case of the late Mohammed Salah and Abdul Halim Ashkar and other cases. And there are others I'm not mentioning. But what I remember about that period was how much fear there was in the community, and how much fear there was even to come forward and support these people who were facing this repression. And the isolation that they felt was certainly helped the government. And I'm not saying that fear was unjustified. You know, it was a real atmosphere of terror. I'm often shocked when I shouldn't be shocked. I hear a lot of Americans, what they call normies, say, oh, I wish we could go back to the spirit after 9/11 where everyone was united. No, it was a period of fear and terror for large communities in the United States. And what the point I want to get to is eventually that fear broke. And people started to support each other. And that made an enormous difference in subsequent efforts by the government to isolate people, to subpoena them, raiding homes and so on. People started to come out and support each other. And that defeated, in many cases, those government repression efforts. So just listening to you, I'm reflecting on that experience that we had in the United States after 9/11 and the importance of solidarity, the importance of people showing up when there are trials, showing up in court, showing up outside the court. I mean, you know, judges, of course, I'm not advocating that anyone should unduly influence a judicial process, but judges are human, juries are human. When they see that there is broad support for someone who's being accused, it makes them think, hang on, what's going on here? This isn't just some sort of common criminal, but there's a bigger story here that is driving a lot of people to care about what's going on here. And I've heard it many times that public support makes an enormous difference. So I'm hearing something similar from you, I think. Go ahead, yes. Max.
Can I just say one thing? I was struck during Nora's, as I often am during Nora's news rundowns, of just how, you know, if you try and make sense about a dad finding his daughter face down with her roller skate, nothing like that makes, you can never make sense of anything, this horror. But, you know, since Palestine Action started, we've had over 500 actions. 500 different direct actions. And it makes sense to people. It makes sense to people who are watching a genocide to take action, take matters into their own hands. It is something that allows us to process what we're seeing. We're seeing something so horrible, so I have to do something that I've never done before. And almost 1,000 different people in the UK have come to the same conclusion. And it's truly inspirational to be a part of. We are doing something that no one has ever done before. The diversity of tactics that we're deploying, whether you are a truck company, a computer company, a cleaning company, if you contract with Elbit, you can expect Palestine Action. It has become extremely difficult for the Israeli war machine to do business in the UK. And this is a model that is repeatable everywhere. And everyone is getting the same images across their phones and their computer screens every morning. And the tactics that we have deploying are working, and they are not only working, but they are reasonable given what's happening right now.
Yeah, I think you said that so well. I mean, the visceral, the physical reaction that many of us around the world have to seeing this genocide being live streamed 24 hours a day. For nearly 12 months now, a whole year. And people feel obligated to do something about it, especially when we see the people in power in the UK and here in the US, trying to get us to replace action with just, you know, platitudes and words that resemble some sort of empathy while still handing over, you know, these MK-48, whatever, bunker buster bombs that are obliterating children, sleeping families in their tents on the sea. I mean, it's just, it makes you feel like you're going crazy. And so to be able to channel that into action, I mean, obviously that's incredibly powerful for people. And for those who can't put their bodies on the line like that, what are some ways, what are some other, you know, diversity of tactics you mentioned? What are some ways that people can be involved in groups like Palestine Action without, smashing up weapons factories directly?
Go on.
I was going to say, although I'm not going to ask that question because we might get the program might get nuked. Go ahead and answer Nora's question.
I think
non-violence, direct action, you know, that route. Yeah.
Let me put the question this way. You do a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Which have been now habitually ruled by British courts to be entirely legal and justifiable. If people want to get involved in the whole range of things you do, including prisoner support, and other forms of activity, could be helping to publicize the work you do, organize support for it, educate people about the crimes Elbit is committing against Palestinians in Gaza. How do they learn more about what you do? How do they get in touch? What are the ways that people can get involved through the whole diversity of ways that you work?
So one of them is showing up for the trials, as you mentioned. We have them all across the country. So really, like, wherever you are, there will be something coming up near you, up to those court cases. You can stand outside waving a flag, or you can come inside the public gallery, watch the court cases happening. You can join police station support, so supporting the activists once they get held in police stations and released. We actually are going to hold support workshops that people can join. We also hold training days on direct action and online workshops. So visit our website. There's a workshops page where you can see the different types of ways that you can get involved. I'd say if you're not here, you know, for us with the political prisoners especially and the attacks on our movement, one of the ways of speaking up about them, making it visible, making it known that these people are sacrificing their liberty right now for the Palestinian people, and to make them visible, because obviously one of the main tactics of the state is to isolate people, is to put them behind bars, is to withhold them from being able to have postcards and make phone calls. But we can defeat that by making their faces, their names, and what they've done visible, and that's a really crucial part of showing solidarity with the political prisoners, both here in Britain and, of course, the prisoners in Palestine.
That's exactly it. And yeah, go ahead, Max.
I would also just say that no matter where you are watching this live stream or listening to it, there is an action you can take locally against Elbit. No matter what, even if your cause isn't Palestine, Elbit is involved in repression around the world, from the U.S.-Mexico border to securing mines in the Congo to Azerbaijan and Armenia. These Elbit drones are sold to the world's most repressive governments and to assist in the most extractivist and awful activities imaginable. So it's important to understand that the role Elbit plays in repression worldwide. I mean, one of the things Ali led off by saying is how local communities respond. The first major victory Palestine Action had was in a Kashmiri predominant area here in the UK, when the locals found out that Modi was buying Elbit drones to repress Kashmiris back home. They came out in force, and it became not just a Palestinian issue, but a Kashmiri issue, a local issue. And that was instrumental in that victory. And that's not unique to any one community here in the UK. I promise if you are doing work locally, you are working with a community that's being affected by Elbit drones.
Well, Huda and Max, it has been fantastic to hear everything that's going on. And you are clearly posing a serious challenge to the British state and its involvement in this genocide of the Palestinian people. And last week, of course, we had Matt Kennard on from Declassified UK, who talked about how, although Britain is a relatively small, insignificant country, it plays an outsized role in this genocide. And you are there challenging that role on the ground. So we thank you for giving us all this information. And of course, we remind people that they can find out more at palestineaction.org or by following you on social media. And there's lots of ways they can get involved. And we hope you'll come back again and give us another update soon.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good to
see both of you. Thanks for all you do. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. And we're going to go to the resistance report with John, and then we'll come back and discuss again what has been happening the last 24 hours in Lebanon due to Israeli terrorism attacks on people in Lebanon. So let's bring John on. And hey, John.
Hi, guys. Good interview.
Yeah.
Crazy day.
Yeah. No kidding.
We're going to do our best to cover it all. So. Stick with us.
Great. All right. We'll take it away.
Okay. So we're going to start in the Gaza Strip, even though you might think we would start in Lebanon. We're just going to go in the same order that that we normally do. And in the discussion, we'll dig into some of the theories about what's going on in Lebanon. But we're going to start in Gaza, in southern Gaza. There's your full map of the Gaza Strip. Again, you see the two key corridors, the Nitzarim corridor, and in the south, the Philadelphia corridor. And if we get the zoom in map of Rafah, you can see where multiple operations have taken place just in the last 36 hours. I don't have the video in time for you on the show today. We'll have to dig into that next week. But the reports came in late last night that four Israeli soldiers were killed and four others seriously wounded, including two officers, and the commander was one of the ones killed from the Shaked battalion, which the IDF calls the elite battalion of the Gavadi Brigade, who are currently with the 162nd Division fighting in Rafah. They said that the Qassam Brigades have been destroyed in Rafah, the same claim we've heard all over Gaza, and then as soon as the Israelis reinvade areas, we see that the brigades are not dismantled, they're not destroyed. And this is the same case with Rafah. In the last few days, the commander of the 162nd Division said, we've destroyed Qassam in Rafah. He said that we have dealt with the tunnels. He said he dealt with 203 tunnels along the Philadelphia corridor. But interestingly, he admitted that there was only 9 cross-border tunnels that they found, and all 9 of those tunnels had been previously sealed by Egypt, by Qassam. They were collapsed. And so this whole story that I've been reporting on for weeks from Netanyahu about scuttling the ceasefire and prisoner exchange talks because of staying in the Philadelphia corridor as if it's the oxygen for the Qassam brigades. Again, just another Israeli claim that doesn't match the evidence, even their own evidence that they provided. And there was another attack this morning in Tel Sultan, where we saw a D9 bulldozer get hit by a Yassin. The Israeli military said one was seriously wounded. And then just before we came on air, Qassam dropped a video showing them hitting the D9 yesterday and then burning it today. 24 hours later, it was still abandoned. So Qassam captured the D9 bulldozer and then burned it today. And like I said, I will bring you those on the show next week. The main things from this past week to say is that the field reports have been down on both sides. The Israeli field reports are almost exclusively, as Nora pointed out, attacking hospitals, attacking shelters, school shelters. Hospitals was the previous stage. They're now attacking the shelters, the schools, in a systematic way, more than 75 times since the beginning of July. And they're open about it. In their field reports, they treat it like as if it was a heroic military mission that they bombed from a distance shelters in the 10% of the Gaza Strip that remains for the civilian population. And so Israel has been bragging about that. And as Nora said, the report came out from the Gaza Ministry of Health, listing the names and ages of everybody that they have recorded that's been killed since October 7th. And just a note, they recorded 710 babies under the age of one, so 0 years old. More babies have been killed by Israel than the most generous definition of civilians inside Israel on October 7th. What we'll find out once we get through these numbers of October 7th is that it's going to end up being more than double the number of babies than civilians killed in Israel during the raid on October 7th. So the genocide is not a battle of proportionality, but those statistics about the children are disgusting and something that we should never, ever forget. So let's look at number one here. This is Saraya al-Quds. We have here, again, the fighters right up close to this Israeli tank. And we have these fighters moving through the streets saying, "Here come the sons of Saraya." And we have two units here with two RPG sevens with 85 millimeter warheads. These are not tandem charge warheads. So we're going to watch these fighters here fire two in the same spot to try to make this weapon more effective than it is against the up armor of the Israeli armored vehicles that have surpassed the penetration levels of this weapon. So you can see again, point blank, it's not the best spot to shoot from right at the front. You can see the tank's shape at the front is built for protection at the front. When we see the fighters with the Yassins, they're often going for the back corners or the sides or the turret gaps. So that head-on shot. But then you can see the fighter say, "Launch the second one." So this is like the RPG 7 version of a double tap. And it's interesting to see them use it in a 1-2 punch like this to make a weapon that wouldn't otherwise be effective from that position, gives it a chance to be a little bit more effective. And as I said, there was one soldier wounded in a tank. It's possible that it was this tank. We don't have all the videos from this week. They may come out a little bit later. The Saraya al-Quds video that gives you the long version of them running down through the alley and getting away is from a couple of days ago. It took a couple of days for Saraya al-Quds to put out that video. But again, you can just see the proximity these fighters have after they've been told that they don't exist anymore. These guys got told they don't exist. And then over the last, it's like less than 72 hours since the commander, the Israeli commander said they don't exist anymore, that they're out here blowing up their special forces units. That's what we've seen all along. And the question isn't how many operations are the Qassam Brigades carrying out and Saraya al-Quds carrying out in at this point in this week. We understand they're settling into a battle of attrition. A little later on, I'll mention a letter from Yahya Sinwar that addresses that directly, that this is a battle of attrition. And if once they saw the stage go into this battle of attrition, there's no need to chase the Israeli army along the Philadelphia corridor endlessly. If they move into the city, they get hit. The previous show last week, I was saying that they had moved into the corridor and they weren't into the city. And as we can see from these videos, they did come into the city this week a couple of times, and they're hit. And it's the same thing all throughout Gaza. They're not defeated. They're not dismantled. They're able to reform with whatever losses that they do have. And there's absolutely no question that fighting this war is costly for the resistance. They lose fighters. It's costly for the civilians. We know that, obviously. It's costly for the Israelis. We know that, too. So we're not trying to downplay the casualties, but the Israelis are lying and carrying out psychological operations, and they need to be finished in Gaza. They need to claim Gaza, as we remember. Rafah was the last stand. It was the last place that Israel had to go to be able to claim victory in Gaza. And so they have to tell us, they have to say to us, to their audience, to their domestic audience, that we achieved this goal. And so these are just statements that that don't reflect the reality of the fighting capacity of the groups, because Qassam could see that this battle of attrition was shaping up for months now. And we've seen them adapt their strategy accordingly. So if we go to number two, Tamara. We have, I brought this to you last week and talked about the helicopter crash, the medevac helicopter crash in Rafah last week on the day of our show, September 11th. There was some question whether the resistance had shot down the first medevac helicopter, which we know they have not been doing throughout this war. Well, over the course of the week, I just wanted to update you on the story that and we can look at the next one too, Tamara. That was a graphic version of it. This is the drone footage of it. But what we're seeing here is the medevac helicopter crashing on the berm that we've also been covering throughout this war. The way the D9 armored bulldozers create those berms around the Israeli positions to protect from Yassin fire, to protect from sniper fire. And they've redone the landscape anywhere they are. They set up these massive berms. So the resistance didn't shoot down this helicopter, but the resistance operations is the reason why the helicopter crashed. It crashed on the berm. Two Air Force soldiers were killed. Eight were wounded, including the soldier that they were going to rescue. And the soldier they were going to rescue was hit by RPG fire by the people that their commander said didn't exist in Rafah anymore. So again, we get proof of these operations. So there's the helicopter operation. The resistance didn't shoot it down, but the resistance is the reason it crashed. So let's look at number four here, because Saraya al-Quds captured Israeli mortars. These are Israeli mortars, and they're showing them off here in another return to sender, a genre that I try to bring to you every week because it's an important part of this war. This fighter saying, a message to the cowardly enemy leadership. These are your goods after your soldiers fled from the fight, from the might of our fighters' shells and our artillery. We in Saraya al-Quds Central Battalion were looking out for you. And then here he's loading mortars that were supposed to be fired at Palestinian civilians. He's loading them up and sending them back to fire them at the Netzarim corridor. The shot is at the Netzarim corridor. But like I said, only a handful of operations this week in Gaza. So we'll keep our eyes on that going forward to see how the battle of attrition shapes up. Because if Israel's going to withdraw into the corridors, into defensive positions behind the berms, I think you're going to see a lower number of operations, but you may end up seeing more qualitative operations in that time. Israel doesn't look in any position, especially when we look at what happened in Lebanon today, doesn't look to be in any position to be negotiating for the only way to end this war. Hezbollah said the only way the war in the north is going to end is with a ceasefire in Gaza. Ansar Allah said the only way their attacks on shipping in the Red Sea are going to end is if the blockade of Gaza ends. And these groups have been clear about this from the beginning. And the resistance is ready to fight that battle of attrition. And they have been saying that for a long time. Abu Ubaida said it months ago, as far back as May, that he understood that this was a long battle. And I've brought you quotes from the Israelis since the new year that have said that the Israelis plan on staying in Gaza for multiple years because they haven't achieved their objectives. They haven't destroyed the Hamas government. They haven't destroyed the Hamas fighters. They haven't dismantled, for all their efforts, haven't dismantled the hospital system. It's still the Gaza government in charge of the hospitals. It's still Hamas government in charge of civil defense. It's still Hamas security. It's still the Qassam brigades. And it's still the 10 other fighting forces in Gaza that are still carrying on. None of Israel's objectives have been achieved. They're not getting their people back. And so if they're not willing to negotiate, then it's going to be a war of attrition. And that's what we're seeing. And let's just take one quick look here at the West Bank, because the video was released from the horror of the camps battle. This is in Jenin. This is a Wolf armored vehicle that carries 8 to 12 soldiers in the back, getting hit by a pretty serious roadside bomb there, IEDs that they, that's the reason what you're seeing there is why they say they go in and dig up all of the roads in Jenin and Tulkarm. And there's fighting in Jenin today. This is from the Battle of the Horror of the Camps from 10 days or so ago. But there's fighting in Jenin today. There's fighting in Balata in the camp outside Nablus. There's fighting in Nablus City. There's fighting in Tulkarm and Nur Shams and on the road between Tulkarm and Nur Shams. So the West Bank is still experiencing the escalating operation by the Israelis that wasn't over 10 days ago when they pulled out of Jenin. They said they were going to come back. So just wanted to bring you that video from the battle, the Horror of the Camps battle. So we're going to go to Lebanon now, and I just want to begin by giving the rough overview of what happened yesterday. At 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, local time in Lebanon, in the middle of the day, after school kids get out of school, after jobs are finished, after people are in grocery stores, and it's the busiest time on the streets, simultaneously, thousands, as many as 3,000 or more pagers associated with Hezbollah and their bureaucrats and their broad social network. It wasn't a target that was aimed directly at fighters. You see lots of footage of these going off in supermarkets, on the bus, on the street, in people's houses. Two children were killed, 2,800 wounded, 300 critically wounded, two healthcare workers killed in the hospital because their pagers went off in the hospital. And so essentially what we're looking at here is, and it was meant to hurt and wound and kill people, because people reported that the messages went off and they went into their pocket to fetch the message and bring it up to face level to look at the number, and it blew up. They have lots of lost eyes, lots of lost hands. And again, this is not aimed at the military cadre. We've seen all over the three main places, all kinds of civilian bureaucrats within the Hezbollah, the government. They're in parliament. They have a massive social apparatus. They have a sporting and health apparatus. And so this targeting is something that the West is bragging about, and the journalists in Israel are bragging about, because it is obviously a significant security breach for Hezbollah. It appears to be a supply chain attack, intercepting the devices at some point in the supply chain and planting explosives in it. Explosives can be like a PETN explosive, could just be a couple of grams. So it can be something that makes it through the scans, makes it through the security checks, and is embedded in the batteries of these pager devices. Hezbollah uses pager devices as a low-tech solution to avoid cell phones and telephone network in general. And it has been a highly effective system until this operation. But the tech supply chain is a complicated and convoluted supply chain, and there's many vulnerabilities in it. And as we've seen, we'll talk more in the discussion about it, but even the companies that are connected to it are saying they didn't actually make the devices that their other companies, maybe front groups or just other smaller companies, all this information will come out in the coming days. So we won't get too much into that. But then today, so yesterday's attack is in the middle of the day when kids are getting out of school. Today, they attacked the walkie-talkie system, and they attacked it at the funerals for the people who died yesterday. So the walkie-talkies go off at the funerals and kill people who are at the funerals. We have 9 killed as we're coming on air. But again, these numbers, by the time we say them, are going to be out of date. But again, you're seeing many killed and hundreds wounded by this attack by Israel. That is presumably them pulling a kill switch on a network that they were already in. And I think the second with the walkie-talkies shows that they it was either outed, their network was either outed, and this is the kill switch to destroy the evidence and to wound the people, an attempt to see who got wounded and use that as intelligence. We know that there's been an intelligence breach in Hezbollah, the assassination of Fuad Shukr, in the Dahia a couple months ago was a security breach that Hezbollah did not expect. And in the coming days, I think we'll learn a lot more about this. Nasrallah is supposed to speak tomorrow, and he'll give us the take from the party and how they're approaching it. But they said today, overnight, they said that the war with Gaza in solidarity with Gaza will continue. Nothing changes, and another reckoning is to come. So they carried out operations in the same way that they were the day before when their pagers weren't blowing up. The next day, today, those operations have continued. So we're going to look at those operations, and then we'll go to the discussion after and talk about it. If we look at map X, you can see this is the map of the border. I mean, there's no border. Israel doesn't have borders. There's an armistice line between Lebanon and Israel, and you can see the blue attacks are Israeli attacks, and the orange ones are Hezbollah attacks. So you can see that they're pretty much evenly distributed from the western edge of the Galilee, across the upper Galilee, the Galilee Panhandle, and then over into the occupied Golan Heights, which was hit last night after the pager event happened. And Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, he said that security can only be restored in the north with a military operation. They've been saying this for a while. Israel Netanyahu put together a rubber stamp cabinet, war cabinet, after the previous war cabinet resigned. And his war cabinet rubber stamped that the northern communities going home, the 200,000 people that are out, plus more than 200,000 people that are out of the 40 settlements along the north, are now part of the war goals. Netanyahu has been saying that for a couple of months now, that he's added moving people back into their communities as part of the Gaza war goal. But as we know, the Gaza war ends only in a negotiation. And it doesn't look like Israel is in a position to do that. And just to note that the 98th Division of the Israeli military is the one that I've been talking about for the last 6 months, because they're the division that's been raiding throughout Gaza. They raided Shifa Hospital the second time and created the mass grave. They raided Shujaiya. They raided the southern Jabalia refugee camp. They raided Khan Yunis the second time. And they were planning to come back to Gaza to raid in Gaza. They were pulled yesterday up to the northern border. So that raider unit that has urban warfare training from the last, you know, 6, 9 months, 12 months, because they've been in the battle since the beginning. They're sending what you could call their most experienced fighters up to the northern border. So when we watch the war of attrition in Gaza, we'll keep our eyes peeled on that too, because that's an interesting development, because they're the Israelis' most battle-tested units. So let's look at number 10, Tamara. This is a Cornet anti-tank guided missile strike here on a Israeli convoy. You can see the convoy going up the hill there, Hezbollah tracking it. This is in the Sheba Farms, occupied Sheba Farms, Israeli occupied territory from Lebanon that didn't come back during the Israeli pullout in 2000. And you can see the Cornet anti-tank, the Iranian version of the Cornet anti-tank guided missile here chasing. The field report on Saturday, this attack's from Saturday, it identified that as a Merkava. I'm not sure that it's a Merkava. It's difficult to see at the time of day and the distance that this is shot at. These Cornet anti-tank guided missiles, they can travel between 5 to 7, and their better ones up to 10 kilometers. So it's difficult to get camera work. And that's the difference between these videos and the videos we see from Gaza, of course, where you get the intimate, like we just saw from Sarai al-Quds, where they're basically spitting distance from the tank. These are long distance operations that Hezbollah is carrying out. And this is one of 800 anti-tank guided missile strikes that they've carried out since October 8th in support of Gaza. If we look at number 11, this is the first time we've seen this rare use of the Mailutka. We saw this system. This is a wire guided anti-tank missile system. We saw it used in Gaza. Islamic Jihad has one. Sarai al-Quds has one. And there's an Iranian version of it. It's a Soviet weapon. And you can see on this video, that's a cherry picker. The Israelis are using these cherry pickers the crane, the lift there, because they can't send their workers up to fix these technical gear that Hezbollah keeps destroying. They can't get their people up there. They can't get their soldiers up there. Their soldiers have withdrawn more than 10 kilometers from the border to be out of distance of these anti-tank guided missile strikes that we've been watching since October. So this is the first time we've seen the Mailutka used in Lebanon, and the Iranian version is called the Rad. It's a wire-guided anti-tank missile system, and there's three of them that you're watching here. And this is part of the ongoing blinding operations shaping the battlefield for the war to come. And that's what Israel's doing with its detonating the pagers, is attempting to shape the battlefield. And this is happening on the northern border as well. And all of these Israeli positions are coming under attack just constantly, because the Hezbollah attacks are not on civilians. They're on military positions. So if we do number 12 tomorrow, these are Shahed 101s. These are the drones that Hezbollah has been using recently. These are fiberglass. They're lighter. They're electric. They don't make the lawnmower sound. They don't have wooden propellers. They have plastic and fiberglass propellers. And this is something we've been seeing for the last couple weeks. And Hezbollah is showing us settler cameras, showing these flying across Lebanon. If we flip to the next one tomorrow, you can see the I stitched together number 13, a series of civilians showing these, and you can see them flying across. They fly low, they fly slow, they vex Israeli missile defense systems, and that's what you're watching. People just with these cameras here watching them fly low and slow over their heads, aimed at their explosive-laden one-way attack drones. They are precision-guided. And they hit their targets, and the Israelis are unable to deal with them. You don't hear sirens in these videos. They're not tripping sirens. They're just flying in and hitting targets. They killed a soldier last week with one. And it's something that we saw several other types of drones being used throughout the war, but these Shahed 101s are interesting. And again, these are targeting bases. That was a targeting of the 210th division base. So interesting to see that. This is, we don't bring too many of these civilian camera ones, but these drone footage of the shot by the civilians is really interesting. Okay, let's look at number 14, because this is a first person view drone. They're doing these, loading up these drones with a camera to take us on the ride and take them for the aim. So you can see this is a quadcopter. You can see the propellers there, and they can aim it at the exact spot. We're going to show a second camera here from the side, because they've been sending in, I think that's a camera from the ground, but in the next couple, you're going to see that they've been sending in second drones to capture the first drone. If we look at number 15, it's a good example of it, of this one here. You can see we're going to watch this one come in and hit a radio frequency jammer, which is part of a genre of videos that I bring to you that are videos where Hezbollah targets the device that's supposed to prevent the drone that hits it from hitting it. And so that's what we're going to see here. And then right after they move in on this one, you're going to see a second shot. See, there's the RF jammer that jams, that signals jamming to prevent the signals that the drone fly on. So that should drop the drone. It should scramble the drone. It should misguide the drone. Here's the second drone that they have coming in after, and you can see the damage on the right hand side there. So they're sending multiple drones to shoot the scene of their drone swarms. And when we saw those Shahed 101s, I forgot to mention, we saw them taking off as a drone swarm. And that's something that we've seen as a tactic used increasingly, where they use multiple drones to carry out these operations. If one gets taken down, a second one's on its way. And that's why when we saw the launch, we saw it three ways. We saw three be launched. And so these drone operations, where was the number? It's 215 drone operations, not drones. operations. Not so if it's a drone swarm, that counts as one operation for Hezbollah. And they count their rockets the same way. There's been more than 1,000 rocket attacks. And the number of rockets is something like 10,000 just since January, which is what we're going to look at next after this, after we see this side view. You can see it burning there in the right-hand corner, the drone giving us footage. So they're sending a camera crew along, and then that drone itself becomes an attack drone. It turns around and goes back, and it's also explosive-laden, and it attacks. So these attacks have been carrying up, escalating. We can do number 16. They've been escalating on the north. Hezbollah has been escalating gradually. Here we're seeing buried launchers. I've shown you a bunch of Katyusha launchers that were truck mounted. But here we're seeing a much safer version and something that they have many of, which is these buried launchers. It's much safer for the launch crew that you just saw there using the launch controller. It's much safer for him. There's no metal, truck to be seen to be picked up by drone footage or whatever. And we saw that these rocket bursts was 8x4, the way the Katyusha launchers, multiple launch rocket systems, 8 across, 4 down. So they can launch 32 in one barrage. And the Israeli military said there was 150 rockets fired on Sunday. And just to put that into perspective, as I said, there you can see the 32 again. And this is a buried launcher. So it's a lot safer for the operator. And it's a lot more likely that you're going to conceal it after you launch and not get it hit. These are also targeting military bases. This is an attack on the first one was attack on the Filion base, which is an emergency warehouse of the 210th Division. It maintains, it's a maintenance and logistics center, and it's located 15 kilometers from the border. So they're moving back, but these are targeting bases. Hezbollah has killed less than 10 Israeli civilians. The Majd al-Shams incident, we'll leave out because it's inconclusive what happened at that event. And that is not something that Hezbollah would target, but it was something that Israel took advantage of to make a story of it. But even the 12 that died there more than doubled the number of civilians killed. And so you can see this is civilian footage of the Iron Dome trying to deal with that 32 rocket barrage on this base. And the numbers have gone up. There's a good shot of them taking off the buried launcher. The numbers have gone up. August was 1,300 rockets fired, more than 50 a day, according to Shabak, Israel's internal security service, and more than 8,000 rockets in 2024, which is more than double the July war, which was sort of the rocket war standard. And it's a significant number of rockets. But when Israel, if Israel's pushing for an open war by setting off these pagers and carrying out mass attacks on civilians and killing civilians all over Lebanon, it's not in the south, it's not in the south of the Litani. The phones, the pagers, the walkie-talkies are blowing up all over Lebanon. If they're trying to escalate this war, their war planners are expecting 5,000 rockets in a day. So what Hezbollah has been doing since January is the type of numbers that Israel would get in a less than 36-hour period, according to the way they believe that war is going to be fought. So that's something to keep in mind. And again, not targeting civilians. 422 evacuated settlements, 1,350 border sites, 250 military sites, 450 military barracks, and 200 military bases. That's the targets. They don't target civilians. Unlike in Gaza, where the Israelis are massacring civilians as their war aim, Hezbollah has kept this war in check by not attacking civilians. But as we saw at the beginning, they are attacking military vehicles and military positions in the settlements, because that's what Israel has done, evacuated the settlements and then used them as military positions. And that last footage that you were seeing was the Bahria base, and it's the headquarters of the Patriot batteries, their missile defense, their Iron Dome batteries in the north, and the command and control of missile defense in the north, and it's 12 kilometers from the border. So these are qualitative attacks escalating on the northern border. Number 17 here is, this is the Qassam Brigades in Lebanon carrying out an attack. This is a Type 63, this is the 107 millimeter systems that you see being used in Gaza all the time. This is the Qassam in Lebanon, Palestinians in all the neighboring countries to the one they got kicked out of and are currently experiencing a genocide in. But the fighters of Qassam in southern Lebanon targeted the 300th Western Brigade Division headquarters. So this is in the Western Galilee. With a missile salvo consisting of 30 rocket salvo with 30 rockets. The brigade's artillery position, its maintenance center, and its concentration of enemy forces. So Qassam in Lebanon, that is something to note. We haven't brought you footage from them before, so I wanted to bring that into this particular operation. You can see the multiple rocket launcher. That's the same type of system that was in Gaza previously, but we've seen that they've been hit pretty hard, and the 107 millimeter rocket artillery has been fired by makeshift launch pads, which work just as well. If you get the angles on them, they work just as well as these metal casings. So that's Qassam in Lebanon. And now one more for you here from Lebanon. This is a really weird story that probably would have just fallen through the cracks, but Hezbollah stepped up and gave us the second half of the story. So on Sunday morning, Sunday late morning, leaflets were dropped. If we show 18A here, these leaflets were dropped by the Israeli military over Lebanon, over the village of Al-Wazani in Lebanon, in the Galilee Panhandle, at the node between the Galilee Panhandle and the Upper Galilee, showing a grid map. This is the genocide grid map from Gaza. There has been no evacuation notices in Lebanon. Israel hasn't done that. Hezbollah has moved people out of the south, out of the areas below the Litani River voluntarily, but there hasn't been these grid maps that are associated with the genocide and the ethnic cleansing in Gaza, forcing people to go to move based on these number grids. And that sign says, the notice says, which is signed by the Israeli Defense Forces, it says, all residents, Hezbollah is firing from your area. You must leave your homes and move north by 4 p.m. and not return to this area until the war is over. All who are present in the area after 4 p.m. will be considered terrorists and you'll be slaughtered. That's the diplomatic language from this. And obviously, when these landed, people in Lebanon took a picture of them. And it wasn't clear at the time on Sunday what the scope of this was. If it was an Israeli operation, what the scope of it was. We have no examples of these evacuation order leaflets being dropped on Lebanon. But this is a tool that has been used repeatedly in Gaza. We've watched it for these 11 months in its brutality. This is the way that it's done. So the Israeli media started to comment on these stories and forced the IDF to comment. And the IDF said that they would investigate. And now if we look at number 18 here, on Monday, Hezbollah released a video of these guys here picking up these leaflets and loading them on to their quadcopter, not military, their quadcopter drone. So you can see that's the leaflets. And so what we're seeing here, we didn't understand the scope of it until Hezbollah showed us this. But this is the unit with the commander. We blurred them out. Great job by Tamara, because we can't show their faces on YouTube. So we don't. But you can see that they're just putting their faces right into the camera, exposing exactly who they are and who is doing this. You can see them loading up the essentially the servo motor on the drone that acts essentially like a grenade launcher, is taking these leaflets. And so this is the first time we saw the scope of this operation that this rogue commander is carrying out. And look what it is. It's flying over a group of 20 farmers who are farming their land. And it's presumably a petty commander who's mad that Israelis are all, 200,000, at least 200,000 Israelis are evacuated from 40 plus settlements, according to the National Emergency Management Agency in Israel. So this is just a single drone dropping these flyers over these people working in their garden, working in their fields, and Hezbollah shot it down. Shot it down, took the film, released the film, and showed us this, and just showed the rot in the command and control system of the IDF that we've seen carrying out the crimes all over Gaza. And this was just a checkmate move by Hezbollah to capture the drone, show the video, show the commanders who are carrying out those operations. Because essentially what he's doing, that commander is doing a localized genocide, a localized ethnic cleansing. He's taking the Gaza war paradigm, disgusting paradigm, and bringing it and trying to apply it himself in his unit to get to terrify those farmers that are probably, he's been watching them farm their fields, and they're defended by Radwan units in the area, and they just got petty. That we've seen the Israelis do petty things on the north. We saw them a few months ago, if people remember, when there was fires in northern Israel, the Israeli soldiers were firing tray buckets of fire over the border to try to start fires, and throwing like fired paper out of the catapult over the border. So just that story would have probably slipped through the news because of everything that's happened since then. But recording that for history is, I think, a really important thing. So I'm glad we did that. And thanks to Tamara for doing that blurring. It's a hassle, but it's very worth keeping that video online. So that is Lebanon. And I have just one more thing here to show you. Yemen. On Sunday, this was what happened, according to the Israeli Defense Forces and the air raid sirens. These are air raid sirens going off in the area of Tel Aviv and Yaffa, and Ben Gurion Airport was shut down. 2.5 million Israelis ran to shelters. 5 of them tripped and fell and were hurt running to shelters because they were running from. Let's show it next. The next is 20 tomorrow. Let's show 20. This is what we saw is the launch of the Palestine 2 ballistic missile that Ansar Allah, the Yemeni Armed Forces, Missile Division showed with a nice touch with a keffiyeh on the top. This is a missile that traveled 12,000 kilometers an hour, which is averaged Mach 9. It traveled 2,000 kilometers in 11 minutes. It sent 2.3 million people to shelter. And it defeated Israel's. The reason why I showed that map of the sirens is because that's where the missile made it to. The missile didn't get shot down in the Red Sea by American destroyers, cruise missile destroyers, guided missile destroyers that are all over the Red Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean to knock these down, these missiles down, these types of missiles down that are fired from Iran as well. That's why all those warships are in the area, to knock these down. They didn't get it. And then the missile defense array in Israel didn't get it. Its Arrow didn't get it. Its Iron Dome didn't get it. Its David Sling didn't get it. We don't have exact information about what happened, how it broke up in the air. So it's possible that it was damaged by one of the interceptor missiles. But because of the military sensor in Israel, we can't really know for sure how that happened. But spokesperson Yahya Sari of the Yemeni Armed Forces and Ansar Allah, he spoke to it and he said straightforwardly, this is us entering the fifth round, the fifth stage, the escalation of the battle in the Red Sea. And again, the Yemenis are demanding the end to the blockade on Gaza. And he specifically said that this is not a response to the attack on the port of Hodeidah, which was Israel's response to the Yaffa drone, also Palestinian named drone, that attacked Tel Aviv a couple months back and also made it through Israel's air defense systems. So that was interesting. And what we're looking at here is a solid fuel two-stage missile. This is an advanced ballistic missile that is in the that only a small number of countries have. We don't know exactly. There's some speculation about exactly what it is because it sort of fits in between two or three different types of missile systems that Iran has had. But these are being built in, assembled in Yemen, because that's the Iranian missile program, is to give the expertise and to build these missiles out of parts that can be gotten through other supply chains than just delivering the full missile to the countries in question. And so I just want to say this part of it, we can maybe loop it a couple times while I do this tomorrow, because Yahya Sinwar, who took over after the assassination of Ismail Haniya, took over as the overall leader, at least temporarily, the overall leader of Hamas. The Hamas organization has a rule that the leader of the organization can't be under occupation. They have to be outside. They have to be able to operate outside of control of the Israeli military. But the response to the Haniya assassination was, instead of putting somebody in the position, they unanimously voted to put Yahya Sinwar as the head of the overall head of Hamas. So he's the head of Hamas in Gaza, and now he's the head of the overall Hamas movement. And so what this has done is it's given this opportunity that we hadn't seen before during the war, where Yahya Sinwar is speaking and writing letters to his allies, and we're hearing from him. And this operation was Sunday. This Ansar Allah Yemeni Armed Forces ballistic missile operation was Sunday. And on Monday, Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi gets a letter from Yahya Sinwar saying, "I'm pleased to write this message to you on the occasion of the Prophet's birthday while we are together engaged in the blessed Al-Aqsa flood battle. The Al-Aqsa flood battle has dealt a significant blow to the Zionist project in the region as a whole. I won't read the whole letter. It's long. You can find it online. Your exceptional operation," he's talking about the missile operation, so he's responding to something within hours and getting the message to al-Houthi immediately. So the hiding in the tunnel, not communicating with people, is just obviously not relevant. "Your exceptional operation sent a message to the enemy signaling that the containment and neutralization plans they have failed and that the support fronts are becoming more effective and impactful." And then he said, "The Al-Qassam Brigades successfully executed the October 7th offensive with unmatched expertise and have been engaging in a defensive battle throughout this year, exhausting and deeply wounding the enemy. I assure you that the resistance is well, and what the enemy announces is mere lies and psychological warfare," about dismantling Qassam. It's lies and psychological warfare. "We have prepared ourselves for a prolonged war of attrition that will break the enemy's political will, just as Al-Aqsa flood broke its military will. The combined efforts of our forces and yours, and with the brothers in the Lebanese resistance," so everything we've shown on the show today, "coming together, will defeat this enemy and bring about its downfall." So that's a message that we heard from Yahya Sinwar, an interesting development if he's going to be speaking regularly. I'm not sure operational security-wise, I think it's a bit of a dangerous move, but it's definitely in terms of the value of psychological operations, it's significant. So the Houthis, Ansar Allah, the Yemeni armed forces, escalating with a ballistic missile attack that hit inside Israel, that hit near the airport, that shut down the airport and can be done again, presumably. Okay, so impressive achievement by the Yemeni armed forces. And one last one here, number 22, Yemeni armed forces doing what they do best, which is it 22 or 23? Perfect. Thank you. Destroying MQ-9 Reaper drones by the U.S. Air Force and destroying them and sending them into pieces, the $30 million drones. This is the third drone that Ansar Allah and the Yemeni Armed Forces Missile Division claimed this week alone. Three MQ-9 Reaper drones, $30 million plus a piece, shot down. We've talked about what they're shot down with. We believe they're being shot down with item 358. It's a jet-powered loitering munition that could take down helicopters. So it's an effective weapon that has been used to drop these Reapers out of the sky. This is the 10th U.S. Air Force Reaper downed by the Yemeni since the Battle of the Red Sea began, and at least the 13th Reaper downed by the Yemeni since 2017. All but one confirmed, either by the Pentagon or by video. And then that total, we're talking about $500 million of scrapped drones done by Ansar Allah and the Yemeni armed forces. So those support fronts for Gaza had a good week. And that is the resistance report for this week, day 348 of the genocide. We are now going to bring the group on, and we're going to discuss this pager event in Lebanon and what we can make of it and what we should see in the future about it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that, John. So much happened in a week. Feels like
incredible.
A decade, but yeah.
I think maybe we should kick off with just a few of the news updates that have come through while we've been on air. First of all, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released a short video, according to the Associated Press, after the latest round of explosions in Lebanon. He said, "I have already said we will return the residents to the north safely to their homes, and that is exactly what we will do." Lebanon's health ministry, as I said at the beginning, says that at least 9 people were killed and 300 injured by the second wave of device explosions that occurred today, of course, after the pagers exploded yesterday. Israel's army chief says Israel has drawn up plans for additional actions against Hezbollah and is ready to strike. Quote, "We have many capabilities that we have not yet activated," Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi said, after approving new operational plans at Israel's Northern Command on Wednesday. There's more, but, you know, things are moving rapidly, and we don't know if this is the prelude. And then, of course, Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister, has said that the weight of Israeli activity is moving from Gaza to the north. That doesn't necessarily mean things are going to get any better for people in Gaza. Israel is still maintaining the genocidal siege and starvation. But I think of notable interest is that that over the last few days in Israel, there were reports that Yoav Gallant was going to be replaced by Gideon Sa'ar, another Likud politician. And what's so interesting is you'll recall that a couple of weeks ago we were talking about how Yoav Gallant was opposed to a broader operation on the northern front in Lebanon, saying, Israel basically couldn't do it. The moment had passed. And once threatened with being fired by Netanyahu, all of a sudden Yoav Gallant is singing the tune of let's go to war with Lebanon, basically.
Right. And reiterating the war goal, Gallant and now Netanyahu have echoed each other, saying that one of their major war goals is resettling, or, you know, getting their settlers out of the hotels in Tel Aviv and getting them back to the northern cities and towns, which, sounds like a fever dream. At this point, but this is Israel's this is kind of par for the course for their completely sociopathic war strategies based on, of course, terrorism and psychological ops and genocide. I mean, how, you know, yesterday when we were all getting news that Israel had started this these terror attacks of simultaneously blowing up people's pagers, Craig Mochaber, who's been on this program a few times, he's the former UN official, he said that this is the opening of a dangerous new chapter in global terrorism and likely provoking a wider war in the region. And then today, as we mentioned, a new wave of these exploding communications devices happened a couple hours ago, walkie-talkies. What does this mean? What do these terrorist attacks by Israel on people of Lebanon mean for this wider expanding war, mean for these, you know, these war plans of resettling the north of occupied historic Palestine? What can we say?
Well, we can say that Israel's going, or that Hezbollah is going to switch it up. Fundamentally, yeah. They're going to reevaluate all of their security systems, which would set them up in a better position for the war than having found this out now, which I think leads to the suspicion that Hezbollah had outed this network and that Israel was just playing its last card to both destroy the devices, to destroy evidence, but also to get their last sort of play their last card, where you wound, you blow off the hands of a bunch of bureaucrats, or you get to see who goes into the hospitals, to see who Hezbollah is, to see who's carrying these in their backpacks, because they didn't know who the 3,000 pagers were going to go to ahead of time, right? Hezbollah yeah. distributed these pagers after Israel embedded these explosives into these devices. So they get some intelligence from that, and it opens up a lot of questions, right? Like the assassination of Fuad Shukr happened in a place that I think really surprised Hezbollah. And I think that you'd have to ask the question of how long has this been, this breach been in place? And if yeah. we remember, it's just anecdotal at this point, but we'll remember that Fuad Shukr was assassinated because he got a page to go up to a floor in the building that he was in, and he went up to that floor and he was hit on that floor with the missile. That's just an anecdotal piece of information from that, but that stuck out in my head as soon as we heard about this, because the first question I think is, how long has this been going on, right? How did they do it? And I think we have some answers to those questions. I think you guys have some answers to it. But I think in reality, to use an explosive like PETN, which was used in like the shoe bomber, it's very difficult to detect. It's highly explosive, many fold more explosive than RDX and TNT. And you only need a small amount of it, a very small amount of it, to do serious damage. And so that would allow it to be, to the question, how did it get through Hezbollah right. security? They must have right. taken them all apart and looked at them. And you would have seen anything like plastic explosives or anything like that. You would have identified them. Or if it weighed more ounces than you expected. But when you use this fine powder, I think Hezbollah just got caught on this one. And
so it was, well, I mean, what we know, we don't know obviously, but like, but it's most likely that this was done in a supply chain sort of transaction somewhere along the way before it got into Lebanon.
Yeah. And there's yeah. been a lot of reporting on that over the last 24 hours, and different companies named in different countries, in Hungary and Taiwan, and they've yeah. come out and denied it, and you know, which they would, but on the other hand, they might be telling the truth. This was clearly, I mean, it has to be said, this was clearly a major security breach and an achievement for Israeli intelligence. It's a tactical achievement. Strategically, though, it doesn't change very much. John, you were referring to the reporting from Al Monitor, which is saying that Israel, because there's been a lot of discussion about why they would do it now. Is this part of a sort of programmed and deliberate escalation, or is it, as Al Monitor is reporting, that Israel feared that Hezbollah was about to discover this breach and they set off the devices now for fear of being exposed or to take advantage of them? And I think one thing I thought about, even though we don't know all the answers, I mean, if you go back, there are all these books written over the last few decades about the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence, some of them written by sort of insiders or people close to the Mossad. And you can't always tell what's myth and what's real and what's, sort of aggrandizement. But the Mossad has a long history, and this is really not in dispute, of setting up front companies and front organizations around the world to achieve its goals. And that these companies may operate as, in a sense, legitimate businesses, trading and doing business until they're needed to carry out some kind of sophisticated operation. So that just gives us some context. Whether something like that happened here, we don't know all the answers yet.
The tech supply chain is extremely complicated, more so than other supply chains. There's a lot of chance for vulnerability in that system. And as we've seen with the evidence that's come out, the initial company said, oh, we don't actually make them. This other company makes them. Then the other company said, we license it to this other company. And that's part of the supply chain. And as we know, going back to Edward Snowden, this technology supply chain attacks on these kind of devices, our technology devices, have been a decades-long program to have them be in the manufacturing process, not inserted, but to have them built, ready-made, and then sealed into the computer that they're shipping off, not screwing it open and putting something in. They're embedding them in the process, and that has been something that the NSA has been doing.
This is something that Tamara, I'm going to drop this tweet in the chat if we can put it up, that is from Mohammad Marandi, the Iranian analyst who we've had on the program a couple of times. And he says in this tweet, he says, do not purchase electronic goods produced in the US, Canada, UK, EU, Australia, Taiwan, New Zealand, Japan, or Korea. Do not purchase Western brands that are produced anywhere in the world. They can be weaponized against you and your families. Now, I don't know how practical that is for a lot of us because, you know, we don't have a lot of choices. But that is certainly a sentiment that will resonate in a lot of the world, particularly outside the West, where I think people are going to become much more mistrustful of Western or Western branded technology.
It's such a gross operation to see there when they're just a shopping mall, just shopping.
The children everywhere.
Take a look. And I think this is worth showing because of just the glee that we're almost the glee we're seeing in Western media. I'll drop another tweet.
Ali, can you talk about this? the way that Zionists and Israelis are talking about what happened, as well as the Western media.
Yeah, let's take a look at this tweet from this is from actually a journalist at Declassified UK. John McAvoy, of course, we had Matt Kennard from Declassified UK on last week. And this is just a clip of the reporting. I'm not sure which publication, but presumably some mainstream publication.
And like the New York Times.
Right. Okay. That's what it was. Fatima was in the kitchen on Tuesday when a pager on the table began to beep. Her aunt said she picked up the device to bring it to her father and was holding it when it exploded, mangling her face and leaving the room covered in blood. She said Fatima was trying to take courses in English. Ms. Moussaoui said she loved English. So again, you can see how indiscriminate this is, even though those who are supporting this attack are trying to spin it as, you know, some very sophisticated and targeted operation. And another genre, which may perhaps not so much from journalists, although there may be journalists, but you see this from a lot of supporters of Israel, is they're sort of gleefully claiming that a lot of people were castrated by this. So they're sort of reveling in the in this as a form of sexual violence. Do put that tweet from Leila Al-Aryan back up, please, Tamara. And this makes a point that John alluded to, that a Lebanese, this is, you know, Leila, who we have also had on the live stream to talk about media coverage of the genocide. Leila, of course, who made that brilliant documentary about the genocide in Gaza for Al Jazeera. And we talked about that with her on the program. And she says, she's highlighting this tweet from a Sky News journalist who's quoting a surgeon in Lebanon saying that many patients he's treating following the pager explosion have life-changing injuries, and added, it's a massacre. Whoever did this is a war criminal. And Leila comments, this is what other journalists would call really cool tech. And we've seen a lot of reporting like that, talking about how you know, sophisticated. And here's one, the next one from Patrick Kingsley of the New York Times. That's a tweet from, let me drop this in. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That Leila highlighted. This is from Patrick Kingsley in the New York Times. Although the attack on Tuesday was an eye-catching demonstration of Israel's technological prowess. And so we see this kind of just awe that journalists have. And this really reminds me of a genre I'd noticed in reporting on Ukraine, on the war in Ukraine, even before the genocide in Gaza started. And Tamara, you could show the, yeah, that one. So this is an example from the Daily Beast. Ukrainians invent homemade war machine to gun down Russians. So there's a whole, and we can show the next one there as well. There's a whole genre. If you read this New York Times article, it's talking about how clever Ukrainians are to fit explosives to racing drones and you know, guide them with great skill at Russian targets. And there's another one we can show, Tamara. The MacGyvered weapons in Ukraine's arsenal. So again, there's this whole genre of Western journalism that praises the ingenuity of the plucky underdog. But of course, what we've seen from John, in John's reporting over the last year, is that the local groups in the region, whether they're Palestinian or Lebanese groups, I'm not saying names to not trigger the algorithm, perhaps, are very ingenious in their use of technology, including racing drones, including. Yeah. What we saw right at the beginning from October 7th, being able to drop grenades from drones right onto an Israeli tank, not onto an Israeli kindergarten, onto an Israeli tank. And they are never treated this way by the Western media.
No, I don't think clever has ever been applied to anything.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they run a site, a Twitter site that's called Israel. It's run by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. 10 minutes after the pager started blowing up, they put out a tweet with a row of flags that said, if you're a proud Zionist, retweet, right at that moment. Journalist with the state broadcaster, Israeli Arab Affairs journalist with their Khan News state broadcaster, he put out the Hezbollah martyr posters that they put out, the dignified martyr posters that they put out right away for their lost fighters. They don't hide it like Israel. And he made a joke and put a pager on his head, like a professional state media journalist mocking an attack on largely civilians out in civilian society. They didn't send these off at a certain time at night. They could have blown them up in many different ways, and they chose this way. They chose 3:30 p.m. when people are out of work, walking through the streets, picking up their kids from school, and then today they double tapped it at the funeral of the people who were killed the day before. And they They're so unhinged.
Yeah.
And this tweet I made just a little bit before the program with some screenshots from Al Jazeera that I want to show. I put that in the live stream chat, Tamara, because, you know, again, these walkie-talkies today that blew up, and it's been reported by Al Jazeera and from Lebanese sources that these were ICOM, made by a company called ICOM V82 walkie-talkies that are used by first responders. And if we zoom in on that first image, Tamara, the one on the left, this is Carmen Jouhadar, the Al Jazeera correspondent. This was an exclusive report. And she was in the home of a rescue worker in the village of Burj Rahal in southern Lebanon. And you can see in the background there are women and children in that house. This is a house of 15 people. And in the second photo, you can see the damage caused in this house just to the right of where she's standing. And that's just a bit of it. The camera scans around, but these are stills I took of the devastation to the house by this exploding walkie-talkie, which is used by a first responder in Lebanon. It's not very clear in this image, but you can see in the bottom right there, that's his actual fireman's uniform. And you could read clearly, you can't see it in this image, but you could read clearly that he was a member of the fire brigade and he had a walkie-talkie for his work as a fireman. And they blew up the walkie-talkie in his house, full of women and children, full of civilians. That's what happened today. So it's important to know this when you're reading these Western media reports that are effectively praising this as a pinpoint operation targeting Hezbollah. This was an indiscriminate attack that certainly hit a lot of people associated with Hezbollah, but it hit and put at risk a lot of civilians who had no idea what danger they were carrying around with them or exposed to.
Yeah, I mean, they and I think Rania Khalek, our colleague and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, has said that Israel turned people into bombs. I mean, in any other definition, this would be called terrorism, state terrorism. And yet the New York Times, the New York Post, Wall Street Journal, they're all saying, you know, wow, yeah, like as you said, what a plucky, you know, ingenious, innovative, clever, you know, operation by Israel.
Tamara, if you could put up the TRT World graphic, we can see the illustration of that, like just exactly how people were turned into walking bombs. Look, these are the pages that are said to have been exploded everywhere, and you can just see the impact that it would make on people.
Yeah,
and this is said to be the company. This is the Taiwanese company, which has denied that it came from them. But I guess we'll learn more about that in the coming days.
Well, Ali, I also wanted to ask you, kind of analytically, like the reactions on social media by the Israeli public to this, I thought you had a lot of interesting insight into that.
You know, it's clear, like with the assassinations of Fuad Shukr and Ismail Haniyeh, that Israelis, including Israeli leaders, not just the public, see these types of attacks as achievements in themselves, as victories in themselves. What they don't point to is any kind of strategic vision. I mean, the assassinations of Fuad Shukr, the murder of Ismail Haniyeh. These attacks are clearly tactical successes on Israel's part. I don't think anyone could deny that. But, you know, as our colleague Maureen Claire Murphy asked in a recent analysis, a brilliant analysis that she wrote at the Electronic Intifada, what is Israel's end game? Where do they lead? There is no logical connection between these actions and Israel becoming, you know, a safe, secure country for the people who live in it. There's no way that this type of operation is going to bring Israeli settlers back to the north, as Netanyahu says, and nor would any kind of conventional war. It would only ensure that more Israelis have to leave their homes. So this, what is Israel's strategic vision other than just to spread murder and mayhem and to escalate in the hope perhaps that the United States will be drawn in? And the U.S. officials, although, let's be clear, they enable and assist all of Israel's crimes, at the same time, they're saying escalation to a full-scale war with Lebanon would not serve Israel. They don't seem to have any faith that the Israeli military would do any better against Hezbollah than it did in 2006. It would almost certainly do a lot worse. And, the Israeli military, I know that they were outside John's deadline for today, but there were probably John will talk about them next week. But we saw operations from Qassam in eastern Rafah today, attacking troop carriers, destroying and capturing a D9 bulldozer. This is an eastern Rafah, the first part of Rafah that the Israeli military entered. When was that, John? 4 months ago? After?
Oh, you're muted.
Yeah, May 7th.
May 7th. So it's now, you know, June, July, August, September. It's almost 5 months ago, and the Israeli army cannot secure the eastern outskirts of Rafah. How are they going to do against Hezbollah? So that's the question, is what's the strategic vision? And remember, the U.S. said, Rafah, don't go into Rafah.
Right, it was a red line. Yeah.
It's a red line. Well, they're saying the same about Lebanon now. They're saying that, you know, don't launch a full-scale war with Lebanon. But is that going to stop Israel? Is that going to stop this conflagration getting bigger and bigger? History doesn't suggest it will.
Right. Yeah. All right. Is there anything else that we know? Any other analyses that we can kind of offer at this chaotic time about what's happening in Lebanon? And as you mentioned, John, the Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, was already scheduled to speak tomorrow. The escalation is, anything can happen between now and then. But what should we be watching maybe right now?
Well, it didn't seem to me that those were assassination devices. Those seemed to me to be kill switch devices that would injure people and are sick and terrorism. But they didn't seem like assassination devices. They seemed to be built in a way that, the numbers, they killed children. They probably killed a few people that were in, a compromising position or hit them in a certain way. But out of 3,800 of these to go off, the kill numbers are low. So it does seem to me as though they were in the network getting the data, and then this is their kill switch to destroy the device, to destroy the way that the device was built and how it worked, so that when Hezbollah, which is immediately started reconstructing what's going on here, or maybe, as we've said a couple times, that Hezbollah outed it and that this was their last chance. Their last chance is they're not going to get any more good data. And so what they do is they blow up all of the pagers, and then you track and see who goes to what hospitals. you track and see which person you didn't think was Hezbollah or would have a Hezbollah pager. But the people that we're seeing, you know, we're seeing bureaucrats. We're not seeing medics. We're seeing people on buses and in grocery stores. We're not seeing Radwan forces on the front line being assassinated and having a deadly impact. There has been some impact of assassinations that this seems to suggest that they have been in the system and the system worked. I think the assassination of Fuad Shukr is right from the minute it happened. We were, how did that happen? Because that system is supposed to be airtight. And it didn't appear to be airtight. But yeah, Hezbollah is just going to react to that and change up all of their systems. So Israel loses whatever advantage they had by tracking that data. Maybe they've tracked the data to particular launch sites, to particular to people that they didn't know were connected to who or who. But once you shake that system up, that information is degraded in value. And then to just do it on the second day with the walkie-talkies just seems like Israel trying to be that, like, you know, mad dog in the Middle East, right? Like so crazy that you don't want to mess with them, that thing that they've been doing for 50 or 75 years.
And it doesn't work, though. I mean, it doesn't work. That's the point.
Right? The point you made.
It does the opposite. I mean, this is the point, is that the madder a dog Israel makes itself, the greater the determination of people in the region to get it out of the region, like a Rhodesia or like an apartheid South Africa. That this is a foreign entity that has no place here, that we can never be safe, we can never develop peacefully while this enemy is among us. That is the conviction that grows, and you have to put this in that bigger context that the resistance has never been stronger. Yes, as Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, said in his speech a few weeks ago, we're not at the same level speaking for Hezbollah, that Hezbollah is not at the same military level. We don't have parity with Israel. And I commented at the time that I thought it was interesting that he emphasized that, because I think he wanted to give people a sort of a reality check about expectations. That doesn't in any way limit the determination of the resistance. And it is clearly making advances all the time. But my point here is that the bet on accommodating Israel and saying, okay, let's just let bygones be bygones and have the Abraham Accords and we all sign peace treaties, that's just not a viable strategy. And the regimes that have done that are feeling, you know, increasingly uncomfortable, let's say, because the people with the resistance across the region. Yeah. I mean, of course, there are always within every society, there's a class of people or a segment of the society whose interests are tied to the, you know, imperial or neo-imperial power. That's a given. But Israel is not making itself any friends, let's say.
Right. And he was saying they don't have parity in weapons, right? They don't have billions of dollars being given to them by the U.S. They don't have diplomatic support in all of these environments to carry on a political war. That's true. But they can defeat Israel in a war, no question. No question. If Israel open a war with Hezbollah, Hezbollah can win that war.
Absolutely. Well, which they did in 2006, and we've seen again, you know, not to go over the same ground, that the Israeli military, again, we have to always highlight this distinction, murdering civilians, blowing children to pieces isn't difficult. Anyone with a warplane can do that. What Israel has been unable to achieve is control over any inch of Gaza. There is resistance in every part of Gaza, and week after week, the claims from the Israeli military and political leadership, oh, we've destroyed Hamas, we've destroyed the Al-Quds brigades, you know, that proves to be nonsense. So yeah, that's where we are.
And in the West Bank as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, of course, we'll continue to keep watching.
And of course, I believe that Nasrallah is making a speech.
Yeah.
It may be tomorrow, but certainly in the next couple of days. And this Thursday will be one of the
local.
5 p.m. Tomorrow, local, tomorrow, right?
Okay. Thursday. I'll be watching, and everyone across the region and around the world will be watching too. This is clear. And I think another message that we get from this Israeli operation that I think people who have to make the heavy decisions about how to react will be looking at is that restraint doesn't work. You know, it's a dilemma. It's a catch-22 because all of the groups, again, I'm avoiding the names here to not trigger the algorithm, but all the groups have said, we don't want a bigger war. Yemen has said we don't want a bigger war. Iran has said we don't want a bigger war. What we want is an end to the genocide, and that our actions will stop when the genocide stops and when the Palestinian people stop being murdered by Israel. But that's the dilemma, because any form of restraint or anything that appears to be restraint only encourages Israel to be more aggressive and more like a mad dog. And I think this is another example of that, frankly.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you, Ali. Thanks, Asa and John. Let's look at the website. There are a few, there are always phenomenal features by our writers in Gaza, but I also wanted to highlight analysis piece by Maureen Claire Murphy, as you mentioned, Ali, about where do we go from here? What is Israel's end goal? And also, yeah, I think it's, yep, there we go. What is Israel's end game? Sorry to spring that on you, Tamara. Really very valuable analysis. And yeah.
Yeah. And then there's so much incredible analysis and reporting at the Electronic Intifada this week. I want to highlight a few pieces.
Yeah, Tamara's piece, I also wanted to make sure.
Tamara's piece, absolutely. Yeah. That was what I was going to mention.
Oh, good.
The headline is Rape, Torture, and Murder Inside Israel's Concentration Camps. And this one, actually, just like Maureen's piece, has gone really viral. So if you haven't read it, you're just being a square, to use it, because everyone is reading this piece. Get with the program, read.
It's not an easy read.
And that's what I want to say, is it's harrowing. So I have to warn you that this material is really difficult and disturbing. But Tamara thought that it was really important to bring together pretty much everything we know about the systematic rape, torture, and murder that's going on inside Israel's prisons and concentration camps like Sde Teman. This is really shocking stuff. And if you read it, and again, I want to warn people that this is heavy stuff, it's just remarkable how little this material, which you'll see, it's all really thoroughly sourced. It's coming from Israeli, Palestinian, international human rights organizations, direct testimonies from survivors of this violence. We're not talking about like the Israeli rape hoax where it's, you know, a game of whispers and there are no victims, no survivors. This is firsthand testimonies from the victims and from people who were there and saw it with their own eyes. And almost none of this is being reported again, in Western media. And so it was so important that Tamara brought all this together in this, I think, landmark piece. Yeah. You know, if it's the one piece that really brings it all together. So that was one thing. And then other pieces people want to highlight, there's a lot. I could go on for a long time. So
yeah, we just published a bunch of new features on the website overnight. So please go check out the Electronic Intifada's main page. Scroll through our blogs and blog posts by the editors. I mean, I haven't even read the top four stories up there yet. They're so new. But
I've read a couple of them, and these are always just so incredible. When you think about most of these features are being written by people in Gaza who are still living and trying to survive this genocide, who have been displaced multiple times. There are so many pieces by our friends and colleagues who are writing to commemorate loved ones or friends or colleagues who have been murdered and assassinated in this genocide. And it's so important, the work they're doing and insist on doing at this time.
Yeah.
You know, when your priority is simply to get enough water to survive for the day, to get enough food to survive, to insist on writing. And it's just awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're incredibly honored to be able to publish this kind of just absolutely important, essential material. So please go to electronicintifada.net, check out our latest features, op-eds, blog posts, standalone episodes of the Electronic Intifada podcast. If you haven't already, please sign up for our email list. That's the best way to get in touch with you as we are fighting the censors at various corporate media platforms. So please make sure to get updates. Yeah.
Because remember what happened last week, Nora? A lot of people went to YouTube expecting to see us, and they didn't know we weren't there. And I saw a lot of people writing comments saying, is there no live stream this week? Well, if you were on the email list, you would have known exactly what happened, that we had been censored and that we were still available on other platforms. So that's the value of being on the email list. Of course, you get also one email a day with all our headlines and links to our stories. So at a glance, you can see exactly what we've published. And that allows us to stay in touch with you even when they try and censor us.
That's right. And we are, as we said at the very beginning, also streaming and posting our videos to Rumble and Twitch. You can also watch on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I'm probably missing some, but we're trying to diversify our platforms so that our audience can follow us wherever we go. And again, to sign up for our email list, it's up there at Get Updates. Also, as always, implore our listeners and viewers to hit the Donate Now button, like and subscribe on our YouTube and all the other channels.
And just to say, we don't say this, I feel like we don't, I feel like we can't say it enough, to say thank you to everyone for your support and all the ways you give it, through sharing the stories, through being here and watching, through telling people about it. We had so many messages from people who are outraged by the censorship by YouTube and wanted to show their support to us. It really was touching. And for your gifts and donations that allow us to do all this work, we're able to do and say the things that make the big social media companies and the governments want to censor us, because we're independent. We can bring you the kind of reporting we do because it is fueled and powered and supported and funded by you. And we're able to pay all our writers in Gaza because of support from our readers. So it's also a way that we directly help to sustain people who are trying to survive this genocide. It's very, very important. And we don't usually do this, but can I give a little preview of next week's show?
Yes, please.
Because I'm so excited about it. that next week we're going to have Yusuf El-Jamal, the writer, who was a close friend and colleague of Dr. Rifat Al-Ar'ir, and it's going to be a really special and meaningful episode because Yusuf is going to talk to us about a couple of books he's working on that are coming out soon, that one that brings together the writings of Rifat, and he's also going to talk about how these books are supporting Rifat's family.
Yeah.
So please join us next week when we have Yusuf El-Jamal, and of course we're going to have a lot more as well.
Absolutely. And yeah, so hit that subscribe button. You'll be notified of our, you know, our next live stream, but we will be back next week. And I wanted to give a special shout out to a few people, our colleagues, of course, Maureen Claire Murphy and Ellie for production and writing. Thanks, Asa, for prepping the interview with Hoda and Max today. That was phenomenal. And on behalf of Ali, John, and I, thank you, everybody. And we'll see you next week. Thanks.